Yes, it's true. We're back. Hey, thanks for listening in on another Boing podcast interview special. Yes, I know it's been a while, but I'm back and thrilled as ever to have the privilege, and I do mean a privilege, to interview this month's special guest. Al Jaffe is a name recognized by almost everyone on the planet who has flipped through the pages of a Mad magazine since 1964. Like many of my esteemed guests, there is so much more to the artist behind their perhaps most popular or recognized works. Mr. Jaffe has an incredible story to tell. He has seen it all literally, and at the age of 91 continues to work and share his talents with the world through his beautiful illustrations and brilliant fold-ins at MAD. He co-authored his biography at age 90, and his book, Al Jaffe's MAD Life, is a must-read for avid Jaffe fans. I spent well over an hour with Al talking about his incredible experiences and insight to a wonderfully mad career. That interview coming up next after this message.
I like the fruit flavor of Tricks, Tricks, Tricks. I like the fruit flavor of Tricks, Tricks, Tricks. I like the fruit flavor of Tricks, Tricks, Tricks.
But tricks are meant for kids. Yes, sir. Tricks are for you. It's the corn cereal with fruit flavor goodness.
Fruit colors, too.
So try tricks.
I recall sneaking over to the magazine aisle in the grocery store as a kid at age 10 and thumbing through Mad magazine, leading me straight to the fold-in section. I would gleefully look at the splendor of watercolor art and crazy wackiness before my very eyes that permeated the page, only to be dazzled by the transformation that occurred when the page was folded just right. I may not have always understood the satire, but I fully understood the genius behind the imagery. It was interactive eye candy in 1974. To a 10-year-old, it was glorious. I'm now 47, and you know what? It's still glorious. So sit back in your easy chair, or at your art desk, or wherever you happen to be, and get ready for a 90-minute one-on-one with cartooning legend Al Jaffe. Next. Tell us a little bit about your early days, and I know... I'm assuming you were given the name Abraham at birth.
That's correct.
How did Al Jaffe come to be, and how did this take place? How did the name change happen, or why did that happen?
Well, to be frank with you, what it was is that Abraham was a name given to me because I was named after, I think it was a relative of my mother's. It was usually children were named after people in those days, and this was 1921. But 1921 was not too far away from 1865 when the Civil War took place, and it, you know, in some areas of the South, the Civil War is still going on. So Abraham Lincoln wasn't all that popular. And when I, you know, when I hung out with other kids, they would tease me about it. And as in the schoolyard, when I went to, I think it was either kindergarten or first grade, something like that, they pointed out to me that I was a Yankee. Because of my name, Abraham.
Right.
I mean, even though it's a biblical name and the people in the South are fundamentalists, still they had a sore spot for Abraham Lincoln. And but that didn't bother me, and you know, I didn't think about it much after that. However, when when I graduated from high school and started to look for work, it was a time when Hitler was already operating in Hitler's anti-Semitism was very powerful, and there was a great deal of sympathy in the United States for Hitler, which a lot of people would like to sweep under the rug. And the anti-Semitism that was connected with it permeated a lot of the organizations that hired artists or advertising agencies, for example, would prefer not to hire anyone who was Jewish. So, you know, I always felt that my name Abraham was like a bad mark that was going to prevent me from advancing anywhere.
Right.
And but I didn't do anything about that until one day in the Army. Well, I was I was assigned to the Pentagon. A fellow soldier came by and he was very happy, and you know he had a name that was like Lifshitz or something like that, and he wanted to change it, and he found out that he could do it without any cost, and any soldier could, that you just had to go to the courthouse in Virginia, and it would be done in no time at all. So I said, well, finally, I'll change my name for professional purposes to Alan instead of Abraham. And that's the whole story.
Now, you were born in Savannah, Georgia, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. How did it, from the information that I have, it's that you were born in Savannah, but then you moved to Lithuania, and then you ended up back in the States. Why the move to Lithuania?
My mother, who, she was quite religious, and she found that, you know, the community in Savannah, even though they had a fairly well-established Jewish congregation at the local synagogue and all that. She was a small town, a village girl, really, and she pined for the life that she remembered in Lithuania, but she only intended to go for a short visit for old time's sake, to see her father and sister and other relatives, and so that's where we went the first time. And then my father came after. She was supposed to stay, I think, maybe a month or so, but we stayed a year. And then my father got he was still in Savannah, running a department store, and he became very angry, and he came over and he dragged us back, and then the crash of 1929 took place, and he lost his job, and we were in dire straits, and my mother decided that was a good time to go back again, so she dragged us back to Lithuania. This time we stayed for 3 years, 3 or 4 years. We stayed. The whole thing was about 6 years.
I see.
And then finally, in 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and my father decided he's got to rescue his family. Right. Although Hitler had not invaded Lithuania yet, but he borrowed money from all his relatives, and he came over and insisted that we all come back. And my mother said she asked to stay a little bit longer with my youngest brother, and she would join us, you know, after she settled her affairs there. So my father took me and two of my brothers back to America, and but my mother never came back. We did, however, manage to, through a very devious means, rescue my youngest brother, even after the war had invaded Lithuania. I mean, you know, the Russians invaded Lithuania, but he managed to get my youngest brother out. So he got all his children out, but his wife remained there.
So all this is going on, and when did you start to realize you had this tendency toward, you know, doing some creative work, some art? I mean, when did that fit into all this, you know, back and forth and, you know, during this traumatic time?
One of the pledges I made my father make to me, I loved the Sunday, daily and Sunday funnies in the newspapers. I mean, I just copied them all the time, and so did my brother Harry. The two of us were constantly drawing, and I was more of a cartoonist, and Harry was more of a real artist. I mean, he could do photographic. He would copy photographs, and I copied cartoons. And before we went to Lithuania, I made my father swear that he would send us the comic strips from the newspapers. And throughout the 6 year time that we spent in these travails, every 3 or 4 months we would get this huge roll, because he would save all the cartoons from the daily newspapers and Sunday, roll them up and send it to us. And we loved it. And we used to copy them, and then we would make up our own comic strips using the characters from these funnies. And and in fact, I think we managed to learn to read and write English from the cartoons, because when we first went to Lithuania, I was only 6 and Harry was 4 and a half. And so our strong desire to know what was going on in these comic strips, we asked our mother every word, you know, and she would tell us the word, and then we'd go back and read and ask another word. And it was so important for us to understand what was going on that, you know, pretty soon we started remembering the words. And I really believe that's how, when we returned to America, we were able to enter school and be skipped. Because we knew the language.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a great story. It's funny, and I've interviewed several artists that say that they did this, basically they kind of cut their teeth basically by copying other comics and other cartoons. It's just how they, you know. Now, do you recall your very first paying art job, and what was that about, if you can elaborate on that?
My very first would be difficult, because I think while I was in high school, teachers recommended me to somebody who was doing a newsletter or something like that, and I would make a drawing for it. I don't have any copies, and I don't even remember what they were, but this is during the Depression, and they would give me a dollar or two for making the drawing. So I don't really consider that a paying job. But my first paying job was working for Will Eisner, the creator of The Spirit.
Sure.
And I created a feature I didn't write any kind of story or anything. I made a drawing of the character, and I made a drawing of the sinister characters that he would be facing, and I titled it Inferior Man. You know, it was a very early attempt at some kind of satirical point of view. It was just a silly idea. I showed it to somebody, and this person said, you know, Will Eisner is looking for artists, because he's He's packaging comic books. So why don't you go see him? So I went up there with just this single drawing colored with watercolor of Inferior Man flying through the air. And, of course, Inferior Man looked like Wally Cox, if you remember what he looked like.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, he had stockings on with garters.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And he was flying in underwear shorts with a cape. And my idea was that by day he was this quiet little accountant, and by night he fancied himself Walter Mitty-like as a crime fighter. And then, you know, I wrote one little sequence where he saw a horrible crime going on, and he jumped into a telephone booth and changed into civilian clothes and snuck away.
That's
so
funny.
He wouldn't get into trouble.
That's great.
He was an anti-hero. But Will Eisner said, you know, I like the idea, and I'm going to hire you on staff, $10 a week, and we'll use it as a one- or two-page filler in military comics. And then he said, but we have to change him from an accountant. We have to put him into the Army as a private in the Ordnance Department, where he hands out equipment or something like that. And then by night, he becomes a quirky superhero.
You're probably okay with that.
I was okay with it, but I just didn't know how to handle it, because if you're going to do satire, you have to have some knowledge of what you're satirizing, and I had never been in the Army, so I really didn't know how to handle the Army background of it. I really didn't even know what the section of the Army that Will had put him in. So it wasn't working too well, because I lost the handle on it. But Will was very nice to me, and he kept me doing it for a few issues. And then one day he said to me, I don't think it's working out, but I'm going to get you another job where you continue doing it, because a friend of mine, Ed Cronin, is also packaging comic books, and you can go there and do it. And so I did that for a little while and then moved on. I got a break, which led me to Stan Lee.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you, guys, I know you've had some time with Timely Comics, Atlas, and then Marvel, correct?
Yes. Timely Comics originally, it was originally Timely Comics, and then it changed into Marvel. But I arrived at Timely Comics with a pretty thin portfolio. Stan Lee had just taken over as editor. Simon and Kirby had left to start their own comic business. And I'm sure you're familiar with Simon and Kirby.
Of course, yep.
Joe Simon just recently died, I think. And, they created Captain America. They were really hot. And so I think they went to do a comic book called Crime Doesn't Pay, which was also very successful. But Stan was a kid. I think he was 19 years old when he took over. And I walked in I had been through a few other stages of my beginning career, and I walked into Stanley with a few things to show him, and he looked at my stuff just quickly, and then grabbed a script, handed it to me, and said, if you can do that, you'll keep doing it. And that script was Squat Car Squad. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
No, I'm not. That's never heard of that.
Well, Squat Car Squad was really a ripoff or a takeoff on the Pepsi-Cola cops. Pepsi-Cola, during that period of time, in the very early 40s, maybe 1941 or so, had a half page in newspaper comics where these two bumbling cops would, they would do funny things as crime chasers, and then they would wind up at the end of the panel, slugging down a couple of Pepsi Colas. And so it was, there were a lot of cartoon advertising became very popular at that time in the Sunday newspapers. And so a fellow by the name of Kim Platt, who was a well-known writer at that time, wrote this script and sold it to Stan Lee, called Squat Car Squad, which was based with two bumbling cops, just like the Pepsi-Cola cops. And Stanley handed that script to me and said, if you can do it, you can keep on doing it. So I did it, brought it in. He liked it. And he says, all right, keep on doing it. Now you write it and you draw it. Okay, I did that. And I did quite a number of those. And then one day he came to me and he said, can you do animals?
Okay, yeah.
And he said, I'd like you to create an animal feature for me. So I tried to figure out what kind of an animal can I do that isn't being done already. I mean, the Disney, studios were turning up animal things, and Mighty Mouse was out there. And so I thought, well, no one's doing a seal, so I'll do a seal. So I drew up the character of Silly Seal and brought it to Stan Lee, and he said, great, I like it. He said, now you have to give him a little, a sidekick. And I said, well, how about a pig? And he said, great, we'll call it Ziggy. And that's how Silly Seal and Ziggy Pig came into being.
Yeah, that is incredible because, I have to confess, I never heard of that or seen that. And then one day there was a group of comics I picked up on eBay, and that was in the stack, and I'm going through, and I love the funny animal strips from the yesteryear. I love them in the comics.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the book, and I saw the Ziggy Pig and Silly Seal. I'm like, what is this? And I'm reading it, and I'm laughing, and I didn't even realize it was that you had worked on that. It was your baby. And I thought, the more research I did on it, looked it up, and there it was. I'm going, oh, my God, this is incredible. So you learn something new all the time. And that's why it was one of my big questions that I wanted to ask you, how you got involved with that, and that's interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm full disclosure, I did it until I went into the Air Force. And then, I would walk into the Air Force commissary, and they would always have stacks of periodicals and a lot of comic books, believe it or not. And I'd see Ziggy Pig and Silly Seal coming out every month. And not only, I mean, some of them, they would expand it into just with Ziggy and just with Silly, and it seems that they just couldn't put out enough of it, and it was done by other people because I was no longer there. But I will not relinquish credit for creating them.
Yeah.
I did create them, and then it was done by many, many other artists.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a great story. Now. I guess I'm going to take us to when you finally got hooked up with Mad Magazine. And is that, was it not too long after when you got out of the Air Force, or how, when did that start come into play?
No, when I got out of the Air Force, as a matter of fact, I got in touch with Stan Lee. The war was over, and we were all just sitting around waiting to be discharged. But the military, you know, they had millions of people in the service, and you can't discharge them all in one day. So it took months and months to get out. But one thing I heard from a fellow soldier who said to me, there's a new rule. If you have a job to go to, a confirmed job, they will let you out very early, almost immediately. So I got in touch with Stan Lee, and I said, Stan was had gotten out of the service some months earlier and went back to being the editor. And I said, well, I told him what I just told you, and he said, just tell me who to write a letter to. You have a job if you come here. And I wrote the letter, and I got out three months earlier. And I did have a job with him, and I worked on staff for a couple of years. And one day he came to me and he said, I want to make you an associate editor. And I said, no, thanks. I don't want the responsibility. I was working in the bullpen with a bunch of other guys, and we just came in every day, and we did what we had to do, and we went home at 5 o'clock. So he said, you are going to be an editor whether you like it or not. And so I said, okay, Stan, I'll try, but, you know, I have no experience at this. And he said, you'll be fine. And I was fine. I did a good job until the point where the entire staff was let go. And then we all became freelance. And it was, but however, I don't know if I'm going, just stop me if I'm going on too much.
Oh, no, you're just fine. It's great.
Well, soon after we were all released, they hired back, they turned into Marvel at that point. They had some kind of financial dealings and problems, and so they stopped Timely Comics and started Marvel Comics. And they rehired a lot of people that were necessary on staff for production purposes, some of the superhero editors and so on. And Stan called me and said, I want you to do Super Rabbit. So I started doing Super Rabbit, and I kind of fell in love with Super Rabbit. You know, Silly Seal and Ziggy Pig were sort of wartime characters. Everything, all the adventures that they were on involved fighting the Nazis,
yeah.
Which seems ridiculous to have a little seal and a little pig going after Hitler. But... and all those, the animal strips were beginning to die. After the war, superheroes started to come back to come up. And Timely Comics was concentrating on Captain America, the Human Torch, Submariner, and so on. But teenage became very big. And, so, as the animal strips were fading away, even though I loved doing Super Rabbit, Stan called me up and says, you're not going to do Super Rabbit anymore. You're going to do Patsy Walker.
Wow.
And again, I said to Stan, I've never done a teenage drawing in my life. I mean, I didn't know if I could even draw things other than Ziggy Pig and Silly Seal. So he says, you can do it. Just write story, write. He gave me a title. He said, do a thing called Jeannie. So he said, Jeannie is a teenage girl, and she has, give her a boyfriend, or give her a couple of boyfriends, and just, you know, do it like the way Archie does it. So I did Jeannie for a while, and then they had a successful feature called Patsy Walker, and I guess he was so pleased with my writing of the Jeannie thing, he said, you'll do Patsy Walker now. So I started doing Patsy Walker, and at first it was one comic book, then it was two comic books, then it was three comic books, and I was doing one or two or three a month. It was driving me crazy.
Go ahead.
This is just something I'm curious about, and yeah. I'm sure there may be some listeners that are going to feel the same way when, you know, when you're tasked with something that you're not comfortable with, you're in a, and you're just, you're like, God, you know, I don't draw teenage women or whatever. Did you have like a morgue or some kind of library of books that, or reference pictures that you use? How did you tackle that challenge of, you, like you said, you didn't really have a lot of experience in that genre?
Well, you know, I think many of us, not all, but many of us regarded ourselves as journeyman cartoonists. Any assignment that would come along, sooner or later, we would conquer it. My friends were that way, Will Elder and a number of others that I've known. I even did a crime story that I illustrated for Stan Lee. I only did it once, but so what you do is you take a look at the things that are around that are the best. In romance, I think Stan Drake was a remarkable artist. And I had a lot of his work that I studied, but I also studied, the other successful feature. A friend of mine, Gil Fox, he did I forget the name of the feature. I can't remember now. But he was very good at drawing. Teenage girls. So I studied his style, and eventually, you know, you come up with your own style. It develops. I don't know that. I've recently seen some of my Patsy Walker stuff, and while it wasn't the greatest, it wasn't the worst either.
I do remember seeing some of it, and it's fantastic. So that makes perfect sense. You go with, you know, look at what works, what's working out there at the time, and what's, and then pull.
And you
from
can
it
always,
then...
Todd, if I may interrupt. Sure. You can always. There are many aspects to an assignment. The major advice I would give anyone who was going to get into any business is if you're working for somebody else, is you have to solve their problem. You don't solve your problem.
Right.
And a comic book. It's a combination of things. It's a combination of story. It's a combination of artwork. It's even a combination of proper lettering to fit the whole thing. So if you're a little bit weak in one area, you should be very strong in another area, and it can carry it. I mean, after all, you can't say that. Archie Comics was drawn originally by a great illustrator. I mean, it was, you know, it was this kid with crosshatch lines on the back of his head. I mean,
right.
he wasn't realistic at all. He was a cartoon character. Later on, when Danny DiCarlo took over, he upgraded it a great deal, and so did Stan Goldberg. In my case, I tried to improve my drawing as much as I could, but, you know, there's always a limit. And I'm never going to be a Norman Rockwell. But one has to recognize when you're telling a story in a comic book that the story also has power. And I put a tremendous amount of concentration into writing good stories. I figured that whatever shortcomings there might be in the, you know, particular points of the art, as long as the story was solid, you know, it would carry it. And I think, you know, that's why I was able to do it for 5 years and sold very well.
Yeah, without a doubt. So now you're deep into the Patsy Walker here, and then and you're just still leaning toward Mad, correct?
Well, I wasn't leaning towards Mad. I mean, Mad was probably my natural strong suit, but I never dreamt I'd ever get to anything like that when I was working on Ziggy Pig and Silly Seal and Patsy Walker and Super Evan Genie and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I was just satisfied to make a living, we were, most of us were just peons in this field, and you got paid by the page. It was piecework. The main reason why I liked writing my stuff was not only to help carry the artwork, but you get paid twice. They paid separately for the lettering, they paid separately for the penciling, separately for the inking. So the more you could do, you know, the better living you could make. And that was the prime motive. It wasn't to become another Rembrandt in the business. But when Harvey Kurtzman dragged me into the satire world. I mean, I saw my closest friend, Willie Elder, whom I went to high school, met him. He teamed up with Harvey Kurtzman, and Will Elder and Harvey Kurtzman were the first ones to work on the Mad comic book, along with John Severin and a few others. And I saw their work, and I said, oh, boy, what a dream job this is. Harvey Kurtzman is a genius, and Willie is doing magnificent parodies of other comic features. And I admired it enormously, but never thought for a moment that I'd ever be involved in it. And Harvey Kurtzman called me and asked me if I wanted to work for Mad. And I told him that I couldn't afford to because I had all this comic book stuff from Stan Lee that was, was more lucrative. So we put that off. And then, you know, then Harvey, when he left... he left Mad Magazine to start Trump for Hefner of Playboy. At that point, I joined him. He offered me an editor's job on this new magazine, and I went with it.
I see. Interesting. Okay. And now... this now, but what time period was this around? In the late, was this like early '60s, late 50s?
No, I would say that the meeting with Harvey was probably 1954 or 55.
Okay.
Mid-50s. Yeah.
And then I think a lot of people don't, well, there's probably some that do, of course, but there's probably a bunch of people that do not realize that there was a time period, it was at 57, I think, to 1963, you were doing a strip for the New York
Herald Tribune.
Yeah, that was, and it was like a, and I saw some of those, by the way. I went online and looked, and it's a very elongated style of
tall
strip.
Tall tales.
And it's so, and I looked, I said, these are fantastic. And I, as I'm looking at that, I'm thinking to myself, why did this ever even end? You know, why would this have been cut short? And it just seemed amazing to me that it would, because it's a lot better than stuff I see out there now. So it's, you know, it's, and it was so unique in the fact, you know, it was so vertically enhanced, and hence the name Tall Tales. Was that a really good experience? And
yes,
did you enjoy
I did
doing
it
that?
For about 6 years. The way Tall Tales came about was that I went with Harvey on this Trump thing with Hefner's outfit, and that magazine only lasted 2 issues. So Harvey, we were all out of work at that point, and Harvey said, why don't we all pitch in and publish our own magazine? And he said he created this design, and it was called Humbug. And most of us put our life savings into this publication, which doesn't mean that it was a lot of money. A couple of thousand dollars was a life savings at that time. And and we published that Humbug for 11 issues, and that folded. And now I was... you know, all my savings went into that magazine, and I had no other work, and all my bridges were burned, and I didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine, David Gantz, came to me and said he had sold the comic strip to one of the syndicates through an agent. And I said, well, can I have the name of the agent? Maybe I'll try to create something. And I came up with Tall Tales and took it to the agent, and she sold it immediately. So I was saved by the bell. I'd been, you know, on the ropes for about 6 months, I think.
Mm.
So borrowing on life insurance and all of that kind of stuff. It was a dark period. But that lifted my spirits. And Tall Tales, by the way, was very successful abroad. I don't know how many papers we had in the United States, but because it was pantomime and it didn't need to be translated, it was published in a lot of countries in Asia and Europe. Had over 100 papers. But and it was daily and Sunday.
Wow.
I don't know if you ever saw any of the Sunday pages. There's a guy in Holland who is emailing them to me now, and I don't hardly even remember them anymore. There are collectors who have these Sunday pages of mine, which they hold in very high regard, and I get a kick out of seeing them now. I don't have copies or anything.
I have not seen one. That's incredible. I would love to see that.
Well, if you give me your email, I'll forward them to you.
Oh, definitely. I'll do that.
Oh, so well, I have your email.
Well, that's true. Yeah, through our correspondence before.
Yeah, I have it. So if I figure out how to forward it to, I will, because he recently sent me 6 of them, and in one of them, it just blew my mind because it's six tall panels. And I try to think, you know, very often I try to think of things that would fit into a tall panel so that there would be some logical reason of why these panels are so tall.
Yeah.
So in this one, there's Native American, an Indian, is sitting next to a totem pole. A totem pole made up of a bunch of birds. And my little character comes up to him, and the Indian is the Native American is holding a sign that says, tell your fortune for a dollar. So my character is slapping his knees, laughing and ridiculing this Indian, and the Indian motions with his hand, and lightning comes, and all these totem pole birds descend on the character, and they're fierce. It looks just like Angry Birds.
Right.
And this was... it's very hard to describe this because, you know, there's a transition from a totem pole into live birds, but it's logical in the drawing. It doesn't sound logical when you say it in words. So it's a complete... They were all visuals. And it just blew me away because I recently did a fold-in on Angry Birds. And here is something that I did with Angry Birds in 1961 or something like that.
That's incredible. that's a pretty good run, really. It ran 6 years.
One of the reasons why we believe it died, because I think the feature held up throughout the 6 years on its own, except for one little detail. A new editor came into the Herald Tribune, and I think I'll avoid any kind of libel action by not giving either his name or my opinion of him.
Okay.
But he tried to transform all the comic strips that were in the Herald Tribune syndicate sales were not what everyone thought they should be. Of course, the Herald Tribune was pretty much going out of business, so it didn't have the sales staff it needed. But whatever the reason was, things were not going well. And he decided that to analyze every one of the cartoon strips, and when he came to mind, he said that American people do not like wordless cartoons. Pantomime is not popular in the United States, so if you want to keep doing tall tales, you have to put words in it. Well, I did my best with it, but I'm really a visual cartoonist, not a gag writer.
Yeah.
And so, but I tried to do it, and I did it the best I could, and I think they were passable. I won't say they were brilliant. They were passable. And, of course, immediately all the foreign papers canceled.
I was just going to say, that would, to me, would be a death blow for any kind of international presence.
That's what immediately happened. From 105 papers or something like that, it went down to 3.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Say no more. I get that. Okay.
Well, you know, sometimes meddlers are brilliant, and they can bring things that are moribund back to life. But in most cases, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's sad in that regard. That's really, what a shame. So how did you get to the point where you, what was your first fold in? Because this runs to 63, and it was your first fold in with Matt at, in 64?
64, yeah. It was in the April issue of 64.
So we're at a point now, this ends, and it's 63, so you're getting close to the fold in there, part of your career.
Yeah.
Interesting. And were you kind of hesitant when that job came to you as far as the fold-ins? And is that something totally – or was that your idea, I guess?
Yes,
coming,
that was my idea.
What? Now, how did that process take place? I mean, what was that all about? How did you reach the, you know, that idea?
Well, to put it very simply, I have not been employed – since 1949, my last and only job was with Timely Comics, which, as I said before, dismissed the staff in 1949. So from that point on, I was freelance. Now, when you're freelance, you are on your own. Nobody, you know, very few people come to freelance people and say, you want work? No. What you have to do when you're freelance is you have to hustle work. You know, whether you're an insurance salesman, people aren't going to come looking you up and saying, are you an insurance salesman? I'd like to buy some insurance. No. The insurance salesman goes and knocks on doors. Right. And that's what freelance cartoonists do, essentially. Freelance artists of any kind, writers, you first you create something and then you go and try to peddle it. So when Matt told me that my first appearance in Mad after Harvey Kurtzman was gone, I did one thing for Harvey Kurtzman that appeared in Mad. No, I did one thing that I wrote and drew, and another thing that I just wrote that Jack Davis illustrated. But I don't think much more than that, just a few things for him, and then he left Mad. And then when all these other magazines that Harvey Kurtzman, these two magazines that Harvey Kurtzman and the rest of us were involved in, when they folded, I was sitting on about six or seven scripts that I had written and expected to publish in our magazine. And now I'm out of work. I have no clients. I have no income. So I looked at these scripts and I said, what the hell? I'll call up Mad. They probably hate me because I worked with the competition, and I got Feldstein, and I said to him, look, Al, I don't know if you're be interested in anything I your former enemy but I have a bunch of scripts that I don't have anywhere to put them. And he said, come on down. And it, of course, what it was that Mad had been taken over by Al Feldstein as the editor, and they were, constantly running out of script material to give to the artist. So writers were very important. And I came down there, and they bought all the scripts right on the spot, and I became part of their team, their freelance team. And so now, to make a long story short about the fold-in, you go back to your studio or your home or wherever you work, and you sit down and you say, now, what's the next thing I can do for Mad? And you try to think of something. So I spread out a whole bunch of magazines in front of me, and I said to myself, what can I do for Mad that's current? And I noticed that a lot of the several of the magazines that were in front of me, like Playboy and Life magazine and National Geographic, had these fancy foldouts. So it struck me, maybe Mad might be interested in going in the other direction where, hey, these magazines have these fancy, colorful foldouts. Why not do a cheap Mad black and white fold-in? I took it to Mad, showed it to... The first thing I said to Al Feldstein was, I've got an idea that I think is funny, but you're not going to buy it because it'll mutilate the magazine. So he said, let me see it. And he folded and unfolded. He said, I like this. I'm intrigued. So he ran into Bill Gaines, and when he came out, he said, Bill said, let's go with it. We'll see what happens. And that was in 1964, and then I expected it to be a one-shot. You know, you never dreamt that one day Feldstein would call me up and say, how about another fold-in? And I said, I don't know. I think that was it. And it just kept on like that.
Yeah, boy, did it ever. That's, you know, a funny story about that. And I'm sure there's other kids that can relate to this. Kids at that time. I remember I wasn't always allowed to get Mad when I was younger, but you always saw it. You saw it in the magazine aisle in the stores when I'd go with my mom and the store, whatever. And I always tried my best to, I'd get at it. Sometimes she'd let me, on a good day, she'd let me buy a copy and, you know, get home, take it home. But the whole key was to do the folding without putting a permanent crease.
Yes, right.
In the page. So, but I kind of relate it, and you may laugh or think this is odd, but I relate the fold-ins during my childhood to the Rocky and Bullwinkle show, and I say that with the highest regard because...
Oh, I remember that show.
As a kid, just like in some of your fold-ins, most of them when I was younger, I may not have understood the joke.
Yeah.
But I loved, number one, the transformation, the concept behind your fold-in, and the art that was just so fascinating. Just like Rocky and Bullwinkle, I loved the art, the simplicity, but yet it was so funny, but yet half the time I really didn't know what I was laughing at, you know? So, and then as you get older, you start to really appreciate it when you look back and like, oh my God, this was genius, you know? But it had a mass appeal.
Yes. I've heard similar stories, many times. And of course it makes me feel great because, being able to reach, youngsters, who look at your work and to reach them on different levels, that makes me feel good because, it means that there's more depth to it than just simply something that hits you in the face right off.
Right.
And it's been great fun. I'm still doing it and I'm still enjoying it.
And by the way, there is I'll have this out there on the website when I get the interview posted that you can get the fold-ins, the Mad Fold-In Collection. I believe it goes from 64 to 2010 on Amazon. You can get that book, the volume set there.
Yes. It's a four-volume set.
Right.
It's really beautiful. I mean, I had nothing to do with, getting it done because that's all done by the staff at Mad. They put it all together because they had to go into the archives to dig up all these old fold-ins. And when they told me what they were doing, I said, great, that's wonderful. But you never know what the final product is going to look like. And then when I saw it, it bowled me over because it's really beautifully done. It's one of the most beautiful packages of reproductions, quality paper, The color is excellent. I mean, it's just amazing. I was just so overwhelmed. I couldn't get over it.
Yeah, it had to make you feel good. I mean,
oh, it made me feel like $1 million because, I couldn't imagine anyone putting that much effort into doing this.
Yeah, well, it's just a perfect compliment to what, you know, synonymous with the quality of work you did in there. I mean, it's that's fantastic. And I don't want to force you to go. We covered a lot of ground. I don't want to force you to go backward too far here. But there was one question I didn't ask, and I guess during a lot of this time here, when you know you were out of work and there was a period of just financial drought, were you married at the time with a family?
Yes. I was married in Washington, D.C. While I was still in service. My wife was also in service. It was the wedding of two sergeants. And then when I got out, we bought a home. I didn't know what I was doing. Bought a home, had two children, bought a car, and but it was on the basis of my having a job at Timely Comics, so I did have a weekly income, then like many of my friends, when Timely Comics folded, it didn't fold. What it did, it reorganized and it dismissed most of the staff.
That had to be scary.
Oh, it was terrifying. I mean, you bought all these things because you had a job and it was. I mean, I didn't do a single paying piece of work for about 6 months.
And to me, pressure like that, financial pressure and worry, to me, stifles creativity. So the fact that you broke through that is a miracle.
Actually, what saved me was, as I mentioned before, that Stan Lee called me up and said, I want you to do Super Rabbit, and then he gave me Patsy Walker. So he came to the rescue again. Stan and I had a very warm relationship. I mean, we didn't, we weren't social buddies, but it was still an employer-employee relationship, but we respected each other, and he respected my ability, and he saved me couple of times.
Now, with the Matt Foldins, you were doing another feature, were you not, called Snappy Answers to Stupid Questions?
Yes.
Yeah. how did that come about?
I lived on Long Island, and every time that there was a storm, the antenna on my chimney for my television would get knocked over. So I would have to go out and borrow an extension ladder from my neighbor, and I have a terrible fear of heights. I would climb up and, hug the chimney with one hand while I'm trying to straighten the antenna with the other hand, and then get a pliers out of my back pocket. While I'm doing this, and I'm shaking like a leaf because I'm up 2.5 stories high, and I hear footsteps on the ladder. And as the footsteps get closer and closer to me, my son's voice says, "Where's Mom?" And I said, with trembling voice, I said, "I have killed her and I'm stuffing her down the chimney." At which point the footsteps ran down the ladder and got out of there. So when I came down, I had to profusely apologize to my son, but because my son and daughter went, when you're freelancing, you work home, they come home from school, and the first thing they do is they barge in, and if the mother isn't there, they come to the father, "Where's mom?" You know, so yeah. It's like a cliche. And I apologized to my son later on and so forth, but it kept gnawing at me, and I kept thinking, I was chuckling to myself, because it struck me funny afterwards. I said, kid comes up and asks you, "Where's mom?" And you say, "You've killed her and stuffing her down the chimney." That's a pretty smart-ass thing to say. I mean, yeah. But on the other hand, maybe it wasn't such a bright question to ask when a guy is up there on a chimney, you know. So yeah. I figured, hey, I mean, we're all plagued by these kinds of questions that we either we can't answer them, or the answer is so obvious that the question shouldn't have been asked. So I sat down and I started to think of things that have happened to me. One of them was that I had once scraped the side of my garage when I was trying to back my car in, and my neighbor said, "Did you have an accident?" No, he said, "Have an accident?" I said, "No, thank you. I already have one." You know, so I recalled that one. I said, maybe I can use that one. And yeah. And I brought it in to Al Feldstein at Med, and he immediately loved it. I just, you know, I had about three or four samples, but they were only one answer. And what Feldstein very wisely said to me was, "Al, we can't have, you know, like two drawings on a page with two answers. I mean, it's like eating up too much space with just a small payoff." He said, "How about if we have three answers?" I said, "That's great, Al. We'll do three answers, and then we'll do a blank one where the kid can write in his funny answer." And that's how the whole thing came into being. And then I did paperback books, 8 of them. And they sold like crazy. So, you know, it snappy answers. My son's question has been very good to me.
Yeah, I'll say. That's fantastic. What a great story. Now, you've won countless awards throughout your career, and I don't want to just like broad brush it, but just for the sake of time, you know, there's the National Cartoonist Society Advertising Illustration Award in 73.
Yeah.
Special Features Award for 71 and 75. And then you've got a Rubens Cartoonist of the Year Award in 2008.
Yes.
Going through a lot of these as you kind of do an inventory in your mind. And now, is there any particular one, though, that stands out the most to you or makes you really the proudest looking back on it today? Or are they all equally as special? Or is there just certain ones that really, you know, just mean a lot to you?
Well, I have two answers to that. One is that a neighbor of mine had about 5 children, and someone once asked her which one was her favorite, and she said, "Get out of here." I mean,
right? How can you?
Yeah, but I would have to say the Reuben is the most is the most prestigious, because that represents all the cartoonists or the majority of cartoonists are represented by the Reuben. You know, the award, the Harvey Awards are a particular treasure for me because of my close association with Harvey.
Sure.
So it's very, you know, it's very hard to pick a favorite. I'm very happy that I got any of them.
Now, kind of focusing on the Mad Foldins, what is your process as far as your tools? Do you use, have you converted to digital? Are you still Are you still doing the conventional tools? Like, you use water brush? What?
I'm a dinosaur.
Oh, well, you know, hey, I use some digital myself, but I still like that pencil to paper feel. I don't know what it is, but
you know, I do all my my work I do by hand, and even in the my biography book, in which I did I think anywhere from 65 to 70 illustrations. I would have loved to have colored them all by hand with watercolor, but there was not enough time for that. That would take forever. So I got my very good friend, Ryan Flanders, who is in the art department of Mad Magazine, and he did the coloring on the computer. So that the combination of me and Ryan, I think the illustration came out to be just right. One time I brought I do the paintings of the fold in about twice the size of what it appears like in the magazine. So it's about 15 by 20. So it's a fairly large painting.
Yeah.
And one day I brought it in, and you know, they were all sitting around at their computers, which they can do almost anything on. And I said, boy, I envy you guys. One of these days you got to teach me how to do this fold-in in color, because I'm, you know, it takes me a week to paint this first Schlugener thing. And they all in a chorus said, oh, please, Al, don't stop painting them. We love to see the painting, because there is the computer is marvelous. And if I learned to do it on the computer, I probably could do it in one third the time that it takes me to paint it. But all of these things are just different kinds of tools, and the finished art looks different with different tools. The work looks different, and I happen to enjoy the feel of a brush and paint. I enjoy doing it that way. When I make a mistake, it's much more difficult to correct than it would be to do a couple of clicks on a computer. But
sure.
I figured out how to make massive corrections, and I even enjoy doing that, because it makes me feel good that I know how to do it. So
are your originals going to? Do you keep the originals, or do they go to Mad? Do they have some?
After issue number 317 of Mad, we started getting the originals were returned to all of us. Prior to number 317, it belonged to Mad.
Oh, I see.
So I don't have any of the early any of my art that appeared in Mad prior to number 317. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny. I was in Philadelphia a couple of days ago, or last week rather, and a guy came up to, I was there for a book signing, and he brought a whole batch of my originals from before issue number 317. And for me to autograph, and it kind of gave me a funny feeling that he owns them, but I don't.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That's got to be strange. Do you kind of, and this is maybe, I don't want you to divulge your trade secrets here, but do you, when you have the fold in, do you work, like, how do I, I'm not trying to phrase this question. imagine the fold and finish. You've closed it up. You know, you see the joke. Is that how you work from that way backwards, or do you work from the idea and then, gee, you know, how can I make this fold in and look like something else? Or do you already have the finished idea in your mind and draw that out and then work backward? I mean, is that
no,
you know what I'm saying?
It's logical steps. First thing that happens is the people at Mad Magazine nowadays. That's not the way it worked years ago, but nowadays they have a group of very, very smart editors at Mad now, young, bright guys, and they have their ear to what's going on in the world of movies, television, internet, and all of that stuff, some of which I'm not as familiar with.
Sure.
So they have a bull session in which they kick around ideas that are hot, that may involve a celebrity like Kim Kardashian or Bieber or someone like that, whom I hardly have any idea about. And they come up with the topic, and they call me and they say, we would love to see something about such and such and such and such and such and such. And I say, okay. And they tell me what's behind it all. And, you know, we talk about it. Then I sit down with a sheet of paper and I try to figure out what the what the finished picture would be. Let's say it's Angry Birds. Mm-hmm. So what I do on this, I make a little drawing of the finished shape, and I put a couple of Angry Birds in it, and then I take another sheet of paper and I draw it with an empty space in the middle, and then try to think of what can I fill this in with that would hide the two things on each side. And this is all done with very, very sketchy pencil things. And then finally, the picture comes into my aged brain, and I see the whole thing. Don't ask me how, but I see the solution. And now it's just a matter of making a larger version, which I scan and send to Mad, and they say, great, or they say, well, we'd like you to change such and such, and if I think it'll work better the way they say, then I do it. I try it their way. I mean, we work together very, very well. There's never a problem.
That's
and
great.
You know, it's gotten to the point where we understand each other so well that I can't remember having anything rejected. I mean, my idea goes to them. They tweak it a little bit here and there. It comes back to me. I tweak it for them, send it back, and then they say, great, go with it. And then I just have to start the big picture.
That's a great way of doing it, though. That way you get joint ownership along the way, you know.
Well,
that whole process.
Oh well, it's great fun if you're working with compatible people. You know, it's sure. This is not these guys are not corporate America. These are not Wall Street suit types,
right,
or Madison Avenue suit types. Mad's guys are down to earth guys. All they want to do is get the thing done and get it done as well as we can do it. And since I'm on the same team with them, that's what I want to do.
You've recently co-authored a wonderful biography in 2010 with author Mary Lou Weissman.
That's correct.
It's called L. Jaffe's Mad Life, and it was published, let's see, by It Books, I believe. It's an imprint of HarperCollins. What was that experience like working with Mary Lou Wiseman? Was it a good experience?
Yes. On the whole, it was a wonderful partnership. Mary Lou and I became extremely good friends. We had known each other for many years, but through this project, which went so smoothly between the two of us, I mean, we spent almost, 9-10 months of interviews and recordings, and then she would write a chapter and send it to me, and I would read it and maybe remember something that should be corrected. And it was back and forth, but as far as the illustrations are concerned, I would just read the chapter and go to work. Now, the only part of it that was sometimes a little difficult is that when you rake through the ashes of your life, and there are some very unhappy memories and very sad stories, it's a little bit painful at time. And we all have pain in our lives, and we just have to move on.
Yep, I hear, and that's kind of what molds us too into who we are today.
Yes.
Al, I think we've covered a lot here. Thank you so much again. This was wonderful.
You're welcome. I hope it comes out right.
I am sure it will. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
You too. Bye bye.
All right. Well, that concludes the interview with L. Jaffe. I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. He truly is a legend. Hey, if you want to purchase L. Jaffe's Mad Life biography, published by It Books, you can find it at Amazon.com. The Folden collection that we talked about and referenced in the interview can also be found at Amazon.com, as well as most fine book retailers nearest you. Well, I hear the closing music coming on fast, and I guess this means it's time to head out of here. So I leave you with well wishes and hopes that you will come back to listen to the next Boing podcast. Well, that's it, folks. Good night. Have a great one. Have a great month, and we'll see you later on. Take care. Bye. Dad, this one's for you.